yourself, little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with
Julia Minton.
Yes. And we do have a special guest tonight, and I think our guest is connected with us already. So we're going to take our preliminary show business kind of stuff that we talk about and do a quick version of it. But Julia, why don't you tell them a little bit about how they can contact us and how they can get our previous episodes, the podcast version?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, as I like to say, Bob and I are real people, and you can contact us. We often are on Facebook. You can look us up. Thinking Clearly Radio should come right up, our Facebook page, where we post promos and show notes. And you can have discussions with us and others. And if you can't catch us live, which I know happens, but live is really the best way to participate in the conversation, you can find us on podcasts. If you have a podcast app, just open up, add new feed, search for a new podcast, type in Thinking Clearly, and that should come right up. Or you can go directly to our website, thinkingclearly.libsyn.com.
Mm-hmm. And for those of you who have not listened to the show before and wonder what critical thinking is, very briefly, it's evidence-based, using logic to form our claims and conclusions. So rather than just going to our intuition and the first thing that kind of sounds right to us, feels right, has an emotional impact, we step back a little bit and we understand the issue at hand. And we search for evidence that will lead to a conclusion using logic. So basically, that's what we are up to. And we talk about critical thinking and related topics. And I just want to very briefly, because it's a key to the subject that we're going to talk about, the topic that we're going to talk about with our guest, I want to put this argument, it's a very simple argument out there, and ask you very briefly what you think about it. It consists of a couple premises, which are just declarative sentences that can be true or false.
The case, sort of.
They make the case. Humans die if you electrocute them. That's the first one. The second one is Tim is human. And the conclusion, and we know it's a conclusion because we get a hint, because there's a therefore in front of it. Therefore, you ought not electrocute Tim. So let me go over it again. Humans die if you electrocute them. You got to give them enough voltage long enough. Pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, more than a 9-volt battery.
They're going to die. Tim is human. Well, we could give him the Turing test and make sure he's not artificial intelligence or something like that. But that's pretty straightforward. Those are both descriptive claims. They describe the way the world is.
Mm-hmm. They're statements.
Yes, about the way the world is.
Mm-hmm.
And our conclusion is, therefore, you ought not electrocute Tim. Now, what's different about that conclusion from the
I'm just wondering how Tim got dragged into this. Does he know we're talking about him?
I don't think so. I think we could replace Tim with Jim or Fred, and it wouldn't really make
a difference. Oh, so Tim's just replaceable now. I see. My apologies,
and,
Tim.
And obviously electrocutable. But therefore, you ought not electrocute Tim. Does that follow from the premises?
Well, it's not. There's a leap that takes place there.
Mm-hmm.
And that leap is in the death part. We say that humans die if you electrocute them. Tim is human. Therefore, you ought not electrocute Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess dying's bad.
Oh, but it doesn't say that in the premises.
It doesn't.
No.
Maybe Tim maybe has it coming.
But how much do you have to have it coming in order to electrocute somebody? So the two premises are descriptive about the way the world is. We can check them out. We can substantiate them by evidence. But the conclusion has an ought in it. And that gives us a clue that it's a values-based conclusion. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight,
mm-hmm.
because it's an intriguing subject. So we're going to get into a discussion with our guest about how critical thinkers can best identify and reason through values-based moral ethical arguments. And our guest is Benjamin Schaefer, professor of philosophy from Humboldt State University. And maybe you could say a bit more about him.
Oh, yeah, sure. We're happy to have Dr. Schaefer here. He has a PhD in philosophy from UC Santa Cruz. And Dr. Benjamin Schaefer began his career in the philosophy department at HSU in 1994. His interests in race and racism led him to develop an HSU course on race, racism, and philosophy, which became a requirement for the major. Let's see, you better watch out, though, because this doctor of philosophy is also keeping score for the Humboldt Crabs, that is. During his summers, Dr. Schaefer trades in his office hours for the score box at the Arcata Ballpark, where he has been the official Crabs scorekeeper for 20 years. So Benjamin, when he's working, not during the summer, is currently the chair of the philosophy department and is listed in the spring 2019 class schedule as teaching philosophy 342, Descartes, Locke, and Hume, and philosophy 485, James's Radical Empiricism. Benjamin, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Well, good evening, Julie and Bob. Thanks for having me.
Well, Benjamin, before we get started, I do want to remind the listeners that we'll open the phone lines for your questions for Benjamin around 7:45, 7:50, something like that. And at that time, we'll announce it and we'll give the call-in numbers when the lines are open. Between now and then, of course, you can call 707-923-3911 and pledge during our membership fund drive, pledge drive.
Support KMED Community Radio.
Benjamin, let me start out this way. Julia makes fun of me.
Just a little.
A lot of times. But she makes fun of me by calling it adorable.
You are.
Yeah, well, how do you say that now? How does that sound?
You're adorable.
Yeah, but she does that when I talk
it's
about...
It's only a couple occasions.
Yeah. When I reveal my naivete by saying that it's only since doing this show that I began to really think about the fundamental difference between arguments involving what is and those that argue for what ought to be, that is, arguments that support certain facts that can be true or false, mixed in with arguments that involve human values, ethics, morals, or aesthetics, or legal issues. And we often associate that with Hume's law after the 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. Now, this is an oversimplified interpretation of Hume, but some people interpret Hume as saying you cannot deduce moral conclusions featuring moral words such as ought from non-moral premises, as in the example that we talked about a few minutes ago. That is, premises for which moral words are absent. So why don't you start us off by using your expertise as a philosopher to tell us what you think about this is-ought situation.
Well, first thing I would say about Hume is there is some scholarly debate about what exactly Hume's argument. But there is some scholarly debate about whether Hume actually meant it that way or if he just meant a logical point that you can't derive a statement with ought from a bunch of premises that don't have ought in the premises, because that's just the nature of valid arguments. So, but anyway, I think it clearly is a fallacy in most cases to derive how we ought to behave from how things are. And I think the most common place that you see it is often in court. About what's natural.
And Benjamin?
Yes.
Your phone connection's going in and out a little bit, so I'm just going to ask you to talk real clearly into the phones, and hopefully that'll hold steady.
Okay, I'm going to hold the microphone up to my mouth. Is that better?
A little bit, thank you.
I forget where I was now, but anyway, I think I was saying something that I think you find this kind of fallacy reason. Often in claims about what's natural, you claim something is something is natural and therefore we ought to do it, or it's unnatural and therefore we ought not to do it. I think that's often the place where we see that kind of fallacy happen quite a bit.
Sort of like the naturalistic fallacy?
Yeah, the naturalistic fallacy is a version of that. You know, arguments against homosexuality, for example, are perfect examples. You know, you claim that it's unnatural and therefore people ought not to engage in it. And that's supposed to be a moral claim. But clearly, the morality doesn't have anything to do with whether it's natural or not. The morality has to do with whether it harms oneself or other people. So it is essentially a non-sequitur to claim that because it's unnatural, therefore people oughtn't engage in such relationships.
Well, Benjamin, did you hear the simple argument that we started off the show with. Humans die if you electrocute them. Tim is human, therefore you ought not to electrocute Tim. Let's use that as an example. Are you saying that that's a legitimate argument?
No. Let me clarify the places where it is legitimate. So here's one place I just think we should be clear on it, where it is legitimate, and that's in means ends thinking. So, for example, you know, I want to learn how to play the guitar, and I want to get good at playing the guitar. So that's a factual claim about me. There's a further factual premise, which is that the way you get good at playing the guitar is that you practice every day. So from those two premises, I think it does follow that I ought to practice every day, given that that's what I want and given that that's how I get what I want. So that's just a basic claim about rationality, that, you know, given your ends and given that certain things will promote your ends, those are both factual claims, there's something you ought to do. And those are what Kant called hypothetical imperatives, imperative meaning an ought claim based on a hypothetical situation. So those are cases where it's not a fallacy.
So we could use... We could
a fallacy in moral cases where you're claiming that, as I said, for example, the most common case that I know is where comes claims about what's natural and deriving claims about how we ought to behave morally based on that.
How would you alter that simple argument we talked about there to more clearly link the premises to the conclusion?
Well, you need a premise to the effect that Tim ought not die or that Tim's life is valuable in some way. And I think that's the point. The only way to bridge the gap that Julia mentioned is to insert some kind of value judgment.
Yes.
You can't derive it from an is claim all by itself, without presupposing some ought claim that's suppressed in the argument. That's how you avoid making it a fallacy.
But it seems to me that when you do actually insert that other missing premise, if you want to call it that, that it then becomes a focal point for a very important discussion that we might have with people that we're analyzing the argument with or of, because then that gets into, well, you ought not kill people, but there are cases where maybe you ought to kill people if they're in self-defense or in wartime or that sort of thing. So putting in and making sure that premise is in there that links descriptive to the normative becomes a focal point. And I think people miss that often. People seem to smuggle these oughts into arguments and kind of hope that nobody will find them. I think that's for sure, certainly.
Well, and then in the case you're talking about, too, I think most people, it's just a given that all things considered, we shouldn't kill people. That we don't know anything else about Tim other than all we know is what we're told in the argument. Then we might say, well, all things considered, we shouldn't be killing Tim. But if we find out, we might decide that Tim deserves it for some reason. That would be a different case. So I think that's why people do that, is often when they do it, they're just taking it for granted that the value judgment that they're pressing goes without saying.
I think we see that a lot. For instance, I keep coming back to the naturalistic fallacy, that it's natural, therefore it's good. It's more natural. And the value there is that nature, more natural is better, therefore that's what we ought to do, or natural thing.
Yeah, but if that is missing in the premises, then it doesn't bring up the discussion, the back and forth of, well, I have some exceptions to that. If it's natural, it's good.
Sure.
There's lots of exceptions to that. And that becomes the focal point of the discussion, in my opinion. And the point I'm trying to make in doing this episode, and what became important to me when I realized that, is that it's these missing premises, or premises that we just sort of take for granted as common sense, or infer that they're there. Missing premises are important to include, because they often become the pivotal part of the argument.
Being a part of a society, I think we have a lot of a sort of unspoken, agreed moral values. But of course, the more diverse our society is, the more we do need to talk about those, and that they may not be safe assumptions. I have a question for you, Benjamin. It's really been interesting watching Bob squirm as he acclimates himself to the idea of moral reasoning and ethics, and I have been enjoying it quite a bit.
This is the point at which she calls it adorable.
But For Bob, it has been those words, ought versus is, that has sort of been your identifier, the way to kind of say this is more of a moral ethical argument and this is more of a factual reasoning. How can we help Bob and other critical thinkers identify value-based moral ethical parts of an argument? Besides, you know, you talked about how ought can be used in different ways and doesn't necessarily signify values, although they can. What are other indicators that we can look for to identify these moral statements and arguments?
Well, ought is probably the most common. Just calling something good often sometimes means morally good as well. Just is a good one. Usually, if you're claiming that something is just, that's clearly a moral implication. I would say I would say those are the main ones.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, and we're still getting, Benjamin, we're still getting a little of that in and out. I think it's sometimes it's, and we've had this before, and I do it myself, is that we move around a little bit or, you know, not talk right into it. But it makes a difference in terms of listeners being able to actually hear it. So,
yeah, I'm going to remove my headphones and try to speak.
Okay.
And right. I just do want to take a minute to thank Sue and Coleman at Windy Gap. Thank you for your pledge and membership. Coleman appreciates helping people develop their critical thinking skills. We do it for you, Coleman. Thank you.
Thank you much.
Okay. Now I'm just speaking directly into the phone now.
Okay.
Great.
That
it does sound a little bit better. Thank you.
Very good.
Let's see. So our arguments that include a mixture of support for descriptive facts, much like our earlier argument, while also arguing for what should be, often miss premises necessary to link the what is part of the argument with the should be part of the argument. Again, coming back to Tim.
I think that's the question, and we talked about it a little bit. Should we demand, well, there's a should right there. Should we demand?
It's hard to avoid, isn't it?
Or request in an argument that we're analyzing that the link be obvious, that the link between the descriptive and the normative be obvious. You already talked a little bit about, you know, common sense or just everyday rationality. We can imply that they're there but not stated. What's your take on that?
It's part of my training as a philosopher that everything should be made obvious and made clear. Because often the suppressed premise is precisely the one that's questionable.
Right.
And that's partially why it's suppressed. So, you know, for example, when I'm teaching a philosophy class, I write out even the suppressed premises. I number them on the board often for students so that we can address them that way in turn. And or sometimes I will skip one on purpose to see and then ask, okay, what's going on here? What premise is needed now to develop this argument? Because I think it's important to be really clear on precisely what you're assuming and how you're claiming that leads to your conclusion.
I'm wondering if when you actually put in those premises that were suppressed, whether that spawns some discussion that might not have been there before.
No, absolutely. Well, in your case, for example, the perfect case about Tim, you know, it will raise discussions about, okay, is killing always wrong? If it's not always wrong, what are the conditions under which it's not always wrong? So that often becomes, yes, the focus of the conversation.
And then that gets into the whole issue of moral reasoning, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Now, one of the issues that I'd like to get some clarity with on this episode is we're talking about critical thinking. We're not talking about people that are students in undergraduate or graduate philosophy courses. They're getting the more formal training. But logic is in common with both critical thinking and philosophy. How can people who want to develop their critical thinking skills better, how can they deal with these kinds of moral issues without having to take a whole course in moral reasoning?
I'm not really sure that's really entirely possible. I think it's important to read philosophers. You know, we talk about those things, you know, just as if you were going to learn physics, you know, you would have to read physics and be involved in doing physical experiments in physics. Of course, people at home can read books on ethics and things like that, for instance. You know, and there are really good philosophical books on ethics for it. or introductory audiences and things like that.
Do you find that students, even though they have not taken maybe a moral reasoning or moral philosophy class, that they have their own morality, they have their own kind of intuitive ideas about what is right and wrong?
They absolutely do. What's interesting to me, and I think my colleagues would mostly agree, is that most students, and in fact I just read a paper today from a student, most students are completely subjectivist about morality. It's totally subjective to the person. There's no moral facts. There's just whatever you believe. And part of this is because, and part of the reason they think this is in relation to this fact, is a distinction, because their idea is, if you're making an ought claim, and if you and I disagree about that, so you and I disagree about some moral principle, there is no fact that we can appeal to, no empirical fact, as you mentioned earlier, there's no empirical fact we can appeal to settle the disagreement. So they conclude from that that therefore we're both right, and we both have our own truth about it. And that's a really common way that students think about ethics. And beyond that, they don't have a lot. I wouldn't say they have a lot of shared intuitions about ethics that are different, that they're not just ordinary about killing and things like that.
So you're not giving me much hope that people who are attempting to help their critical thinking skills without taking a formal moral reasoning course can do much, even though they have their own sort of intuition, subjective idea of what is right and wrong that they've developed throughout their lifetime. I'm not getting much hope that those folks will actually be able to develop anything beyond their common sense morality, the golden rule, or whatever they
call it. Everybody's an interesting thing about, so for me personally, I think that the issue is, what does it mean to be a good person? In my view, my personal view on this is that, you approach the world with compassion and you approach the world with simple reflection, and that for most cases, your moral guidepost is your basic thinking and the well of compassion that you have to develop in a person, and that if a person doesn't have that, moral reasoning is not going to really help. But I do think if you want to have moral debates with people about policy and things like that, it's important to have some background in moral philosophy, so knowing the difference, for example, between utilitarian arguments and deontological arguments, and those sorts of things become important in that context.
Mm-hmm. You've used some terms there that probably are not, our listeners are not familiar.
I just want to insert that I suspect that Benjamin's shilling for big philosophy.
Shilling.
Yeah. I'm shilling for the importance of philosophy.
Yeah. Well, good.
And more philosophy in general. Although, formal, I wouldn't say such thing as formal moral reasoning. There are moral theories, and there are debates among moral theories, and a person who wants to be a critical thinker about that, I think, needs to familiarize themselves with the various kinds of moral theories, at least in the Western tradition, that they're available to us.
And that's one of the things that we want to do before we get done with this episode, is to talk about some resources that people can actually do that with, and we'll get to that. But you used a couple terms, deontological and
utilitarian.
Utilitarian. There's consequentialism. I know it's a tough one. It's probably a whole semester. But can you just give a real brief idea of what those terms mean?
I can. Well, I can start with consequentialism, because utilitarianism is a version of consequentialism.
Yes.
And consequentialism is essentially the idea, if we're talking about an action, whether it's a moral indicator or not, is that what determines whether it's moral or not is the consequences of the action. So if it causes suffering, on balance, if it causes more suffering than it causes happiness, utilitarians will say it was the wrong thing to do. And vice versa, then it was the right. So that idea of consequentialism is just the idea that the way you measure the morality of an act is by its consequences. Mm-hmm. Deontologists, on the other hand, who were inspired by the philosopher Kant, in opposition to utilitarianism, rather, Kant was a major critic of utilitarianism. And Kant argued that it's not the consequences that matter for morality, it's the intent of the act and the reason we committed the end. So, you may do something that happens to have good consequences, but your intention in doing it was to harm someone. and Kant would say is their intention was to harm someone, and as a matter of luck, it just happened that it had good consequences. You don't want to say that he did the right thing. And mm-hmm. so for Kant, it's why you did it, not what consequences it had. And that's a debate that's been going on basically between those two camps for a long time in Western thinking, that relationship between thinking about the consequences is what matters, as opposed to thinking about the intention behind the action that matters. I mean, some people would say, for instance, that if we just take a simple example like slavery, for instance, I mean, if you just made all the slaves happy by giving them, you know, lots of psychedelic mushrooms while they were working, so that they were happy being slaves, then there's no harm done, because they're fine, but the consequences are they're still happy. But Kantian would say slavery's wrong because it violates the dignity of a person, and whether the person suffers from that violation or is made unhappy by that violation is beside the point. You know, treating people with respect and their rights and honoring their rights is really what morality is about. Even if violating their rights makes them happy, it's still wrong. And so that's sort of the debate in Western ethics, and those two camps have been sort of at it for a while.
So in the pure state of utilitarianism or consequentialism or Kantian categorical imperatives, whichever way you're going, in those pure states, it seems like you get into these debates because someone can always find an example of a point at which that doesn't work. So is it possible to mix these?
There are definitely hybrid versions, and it may be that, you know, there's ways of making this work by saying, well, for example, it may turn out that utilitarianism does account for, you know, this might overcomplicate things, but it might turn out that the best way to be utilitarian is not actually to put utilitarianism into practice. So that you might be utilitarian and want to say, well, I want to promote the greatest good for the greatest number, but the best way for me to do that in action is not to try to do that. Yeah. And mm-hmm. so the best way to promote the greatest good for the greatest number is to act like a non-utilitarian, even though ultimately the consequences would be utilitarian. So that'd be one way to argue it. Some people have argued that if you were a utilitarian every day, if you spent every day, if every action you calculate, Bruce, whether the heck or that affects, you'd actually end up undermining your ability to create the good.
Yeah. But I do want to remind folks that we're talking to Dr. Benjamin Schaefer. He's a philosophy instructor and department chair of the philosophy department at Humboldt State University, and we're talking about how critical thinkers can incorporate moral, ethical ideas into their critical thinking. And the first is to realize what a descriptive versus normative, a fact about the way the world is versus something that has within it human value judgments. And we're talking about the morass and complications of trying to sort out different ways to tackle these moral arguments. And what we've come to, at least to this point, in my view, is that it's complicated, right? There's all kinds of different ways. I heard, and I don't remember her name now, but I heard a clip from an interview of a woman who was training people that were in a military academy of some sort, the officers' training on ethics. And what she recommended to folks is that you inoculate yourself ahead of time, because if you're getting into a debate, analyzing an argument, it's very complicated to go through the moral reasoning to come up with some sort of conclusion, but that you think about these issues. You think about issues of people in various different situations, and what is the right thing to do? What is the moral thing to do? What is in the best interests of individuals, societies as a collective, and that kind of thing, to sort of inoculate yourself so that you have an idea of what your own moral philosophy is ahead of time. And I think that's one thing that we might be able to advise critical thinkers to do, is that you can't go through the whole course, although we're going to try to give you some resources at the end of the program on moral reasoning and moral philosophy, but you can begin to think about various issues and situations and determine reasons why you believe that something is right or wrong.
That's a very good suggestion, Bob. Yeah. And I also want to bring up practicing that sort of reasoning on your own is a good place to start, too, because I think it can be uncomfortable for some people. And you do something that I think is really great, more of us should probably do, which is, you've mentioned before, when you're trying to understand an issue better, you go online and you search for arguments against. Mm-hmm. And you try and understand the opposition. And I think the similar sort of self-reflection and research also works when trying to examine moral quandaries.
Do you have anything to add to that, Benjamin?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I was going to add that was what you said about inoculating yourself was a better way of saying what I was saying earlier about cultivating compassion mm-hmm. before you come to the conversation.
Right.
Because a person who lacks any of that, ethics is not simply a matter of playing logical wiles.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? There's a judgment involved ultimately. And that judgment is itself not always a matter of reason. And it can't be a matter of reason because you have to judge the weight of the value judgments that are involved. And there's no decision procedure for that. And, there has to be. Have to come to this kind of reasoning with being a certain kind of person. And, that was important to the Greeks, for instance. I mean, the Greeks thought that, you had to, in order to be a philosopher, a moral philosopher, we had to want to be a moral person in the first place. And you had to be the kind of person that was open to learning and becoming a better person morally and developing their character mm-hmm. so that when you had to make moral judgments, your character was what guided you when arguments gave out. And I think that's a really important point.
And as I was searching, part of my brain was searching for how folks can develop this. I thought about one way of developing it is to be around children that are discovering their own morality and searching for these questions, because they're going to ask you, but why should I share my toys?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
Yeah. So being a parent might be a good opportunity. And I see our engineer, Eric, smiling about that because he's got a young critter. When they start pondering these issues, you better have your act together a little bit as a parent, because they're going to question you. And that's a good way to sort of practice.
They're not afraid of the hard questions either.
Oh, no. They're great at the hard questions. And this gets into a little complicated issue, but vaccinations are back in the news. Now, we don't do topics.
And how?
We don't do topics on this show. We don't try to argue through critical thinking of various topic. But when we talked in a previous show about this idea of is and ought, we came upon the idea of the...
we're looking for practical examples.
Yeah, practical example.
And something that came up was, of course, the public health policy around mandatory vaccinations for school-age kids.
Yeah, and it's a little more complicated than the previous argument that we had with electrocuting Tim.
Yes, just a little bit.
But let's go into that a little bit because I think it's a good example of a mixture of things that are both descriptive and normative. And this is State Senate Bill 277, which passed in 2015. And that bill in California removed the personal belief exemptions to vaccination requirements for children enrolling in school. And so what we did is we developed the idea of a fictitious senator that was attempting to construct an argument to present in favor of that bill. And if you think it through, that senator would have to support certain descriptive aspects of the argument. And those might be, for example, that vaccinations are safe and effective. Of course, there's a little bit of values in that, because what is safe? Nothing's perfectly safe. Nothing's perfectly effective. So there's value judgments imposed on that. But for the most part, it's fairly, we do research studies.
Those are defined in the science.
Yeah, and we do research studies to determine whether it's safe and effective. And you can present that as evidence. The senator would also need to talk about vaccination rates, the idea that vaccination rates have to be kept high to prevent diseases from spreading, which is the so-called herd immunity. Right?
Or community immunity.
Yeah, community immunity. I like that. Again, that's more of a descriptive claim. You can study that and see if that's true. And also that parental personal belief exemptions threaten that herd immunity. So those are kind of three descriptive parts of that argument. But after that, if the senator then concludes that we should therefore pass a law mandating vaccinations in school settings, then we run into the ought, the should, because we should make a law. And that has all kinds of other issues, because it has the issue of whether the state has responsibility to protect the health of the kids and whether that's their primary responsibility. How does that weigh in with parental responsibility to provide a safe environment for their kids? If they believe that vaccinations cause autism or something else, then they're, in their minds, protecting their kids from that.
And then the community you're protecting.
Right. And the other additional idea that if you mandate vaccinations in public and private schools, then you're essentially almost forcing people who don't want to vaccinate their kids to homeschool or find some other alternative. So there's some should, ought, good, bad, value-based parts of that argument. What do you think of that? I'm laying that on your lap. Yeah, I mean, is that a good, is that an example of a real life argument that has these complications in
it? Yes, it is. Yeah, because I mean, to me, the pertinent question there is when you raise about what's the purview of the state? Is it the state's job? Is it the state's job to protect the community? Because the question is whether it should be a law or not. I think that's the issue. The legal is whether it should be a matter of law or a matter of, like, as opposed to sort of public shaming or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so, then you're raising questions about what ought to be the proper role of the state. And then that's an issue for political theory, which is a branch of moral theory and ethical theory.
So these arguments, these real-life arguments, get complicated fast.
They do.
And oftentimes, I think folks miss the complications. They miss the complications because there's a certain, what you call suppressed premises there that that don't glare out at them.
And I would say, too, it seems to me that, we do necessarily live in the community. And that's just a fact about human beings. And I think that we do have moral obligations about what we believe, because what we believe often affects other people and how we act on our beliefs. And I think we have a moral obligation about things based on the best evidence. And so it seems to me that I'm obligated as a person to make decisions about whether I should vaccinate my child or not, just up to whether I happen to be worried about it or not. I happen to look at the people who are recognized as knowledgeable about that. And if they're saying that the evidence is that it's not dangerous, then I think I have a moral obligation to follow, to where my beliefs affect other people in that way, to follow the best evidence and make a rational decision.
Yeah, because that's another part of that argument, is if you're a parent who refuses to vaccinate your children and you have this personal belief exemption, then you're sending your kids to school unvaccinated. And if the herd immunity drops to the point where children who are in school, and schools are close contact, are in school and they have medical reasons that they can't be vaccinated, because that is that exemption stood, that's still there. They didn't take that away. Then you're putting those kids who have medical issues and reasons why they can't be vaccinated, you're putting them in danger and their families and that sort of thing. So, yeah, there's lots of issues. So I think the takeaway, is, as far as I'm concerned, with this whole discussion, is that besides being complicated, it's something that if you really want to engage in critical thinking, that it's important to get some more information, some more resources, and do some serious thinking. But you can start by trying to pick out of arguments, to analyze them, and to spot those values, human values-based parts of the argument.
Yeah, and the suppressed premises.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
I'm just going to, at this point, Benjamin, invite listeners to call and weigh in. You might have some questions for a philosopher who has been teaching philosophy for a good amount of time, Benjamin Schaefer, Dr. Benjamin Schaefer from Humboldt State University. You don't get a chance to pick the mind of a philosopher very often, you know.
It's true.
We do have a caller. So, caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Do you have a question for us?
Oh, I've got, you know, I don't know. Yeah. Yes, I do.
Are you in a moral quandary?
No, not at the moment. But like, I've always asked this question, is that what do we know to be true? What do we know to be true? What do you, like, personally know to be true? Is there an absolute truth? I absolutely believe there is one, an absolute truth. And it's connected to love. It's, to me, for me, it's always connected to, well, what would love have us do? So I want the conversation about what do we know to be true and what is the truth?
Well, let's turn that one over to our philosopher.
Yes, let's go with that one. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, caller.
Right. Okay, thank you. I'll hang up and let other people call up too.
Great, thanks. Well, we just have a little question for you, Dr. Schaefer.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's a truth, but I think what the caller was suggesting, I think I would agree with some of what the caller was suggesting about love. I do think, kind of what I was saying a minute ago, I'll use the word compassion, that in the end, that's the rule. And the rest of the moral discussion that you have is based on, okay, given that, now how do we proceed? You know, given that this is where we're at, now what do we do? And there are still debates within that, and there may not be a single answer. Once we've decided that's where we're starting, that doesn't mean we're going to know what to do or there's a single answer about what to do. There are moral quandaries where there's no good answer, no matter what your intentions are, no matter what you hope to do, you know, no matter how high your hopes are. There's just no right thing to do. There's no way to act without harming someone who doesn't deserve to be harmed or causing great damage to someone. And so, you know, I think there's no truth in that sense as the final step in a decision procedure that will tell you, here's what I will do in this situation, or it will be the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, I don't think there's moral truth like that. I just don't think the moral universe works that way.
Well, yeah, that would be my question is, intuitively, I want to agree about compassion, that our intent should be generally of compassion and love, if you want to go so far. But what's the evidence? Why, what reason do I have to have that as my moral foundation other than my gut?
Well, there, what I would say is that we are expressing our moral skepticism. And I think what I'm saying is I don't think it's possible to answer moral skepticism. I think if a person asks that question, it seriously means, you know, seriously, doesn't get that. Mm-hmm. That there's no amount of reasoning, that there's no reason to say why you should care about the rest of the world, why you should care whether the world survives or whether it goes on another second or not. There's no, what argument could you possibly give that would explain why you should care whether the world continues or stops or whatever. You know, morality takes place once you've decided that it matters, is what I'm saying.
Excellent.
And I would be hesitant to ask any philosopher, is there such a thing as absolute truth?
Right, yeah. And we always talk about, yeah. I don't think anybody knows what that means.
Okay, well, we have a couple other callers on the line, so let's go to the next call.
Hello?
Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, caller.
Hello, yes. I have a question. I want the gentleman to comment what he thinks about it, but my question to the parents that don't want to vaccinate their children because they're afraid of the danger of the vaccine, my question to them is, would you rather your child have the disease or the vaccine that prevents the disease? I don't think that people really think about that. That's what's going on there.
So that would be part of your argument if you were discussing...
Well, most of the diseases that the vaccines prevent are pretty dangerous and mostly fatal. Mm-hmm. And vaccines, there's no real proof that they cause autism. There's no real proof that they really do that much harm. They can say, oh, they have mercury, they have this, they have that. Those are bad things. The little tiny bit of mercury you might get, I never heard of anybody having mercury poison from a vaccine, but having polio or smallpox or diphtheria, you know, could kill you.
We don't want to get off on too much of
I'm not talking about the vaccine moral issue. I just want to know what you think about that as a valid argument for having it.
Okay, let's ask Benjamin.
I think that's a good argument for having it. You know, you weigh the risks for anything you do. I mean, and the risks of not getting the vaccine are the risks associated with not getting the vaccine are far greater than the risks associated with getting it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
So that would be a consequentialist type argument, right? Risk benefit.
Yeah, and also, well, you know, and there even in the context of the person that the caller's asking is, it's more of a, it's not even necessarily a moral question. It's just, you know, you want your kid to die from some horrible disease. Which is far more likely than the person will be damaged by the vaccine. And so, I mean, they make decisions like that all the time. I hope for our children where we weigh what's more risky and what we weigh the risks, and we make decisions based on what's more or less risky.
And that risky, I just want to add that risk assessment should come from evidence.
Yeah, it's my, that's what I was saying, is I think you have an obligation to make those based on evidence. I mean, I guess I was just saying in general, I know this is an aside, but I mean, I think people who question like the science of vaccines or question the science of global warming, I think they tend to pick and choose the science they question because, I mean, they're fine with science in every other aspect of their life. I mean, they live the way they live because of science. They drive cars with computers. They do all sorts of stuff every day that involves science. And science is one big thing. It's all interconnected. It's not like there's biology and that's wormhole thing that's questionable. And then there's physics, and that's a totally different area of science, and that's not question. You know, they're interlinked in such deep ways that it's, you know, you can't, it's ridiculous to pick and choose mm-hmm. which science you're going to accept. It's all science.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, it brings us radio and callers. I think it also brings us another caller.
Yeah, and I just want to say before we leave this, that particular question is a good way to find out if it's a legit, if it's a an argument, not necessarily a legitimate argument, but an argument that actually has some impact on that other person, is to try it out. We try these arguments out. We get an idea of, here's something I thought while I'm in discussion, and you see, because some people who, for example, believe that vaccines cause autism, and they just can't fathom it not being the case. For them, that's absolute truth. It's not typically going to fly very much to point out without some evidence or without some sort of building some sort of relationship with that person where they don't put the walls up. You're probably not going to get very far with that person. So, you know, this is the whole idea of critical thinking is we're thinking it through ourselves. Critical thinking, we're applying some of the same skills, except it's out in the real world. And the real world behaves a little different than philosophy in a classroom or philosophy between various philosophers, because the rules are quite different in actually how we grok information as human beings. Behavioral philosophy, like there's behavior.
We're trying to be tougher with each other. I mean, the whole point is to be critically, you know, to be critical and to have a thick skin, you know. I mean, that's so it's different.
Right. You expect it. Okay, we have another caller. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, caller.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I wanted to comment on what I feel like I'm hearing from your conversation, which feels very much to me like there's this point after evidence, right? Like there are things that we can all agree upon, statistics about immunizations or, you know, like the things that are just true, real, and then, you know, how we define those. So when I'm hearing things on the show about judgment or missing premises is another thing I heard. Assumptions was another thing I heard. Compassion was another thing I heard, absolute truth. When I hear those terms, to me, that's intuition, which I felt like at the very beginning of the show was quickly dismissed, you know, like, we're going to look at the evidence, we're going to look at the evidence. And so then after all of that, I keep hearing like, okay, so there's this evidence that's clear, which is, to me, mutual understanding, that's the social contract, when you say what evidence is. But then we always get to the intuition part, and that's what we need to investigate. We can call it our gut, we can call it our id, we can call it whatever, but once we understand what that judgment is, what the missing premise or the assumption or the absolute truth, is it like Tim has gone through a legitimate process and is in Amsterdam about to be, you know, euthanized by some fabulous, you know, in the way the world they do that, you can die compassionately with dignity. And there's a list of ways in which that can happen. And one of them is electricity kills people. Let's electrocute Tim. I mean, that's just a list of facts that's true. So when we say like our intuition, it's what we feel when we hear these premises. And logic and studying logic and understanding logic and the rhythm and the mathematics and the poetry of it is what allows us to pick apart what we consider facts and real and what is our intuition.
Oopsie, we have to do a little report on that one. But I think what the caller was getting at brought up a very good point about intuition. And I think what I was thinking about, at least in processing that caller's comments, was that we our moral compass is internalized. We have one whether we realize it or not. Mm-hmm. And perhaps it is through examination and these conversations that we understand our already existing intuitive moral compass. That's kind of what I took away from it. But Benjamin, did you catch that? Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's essentially what I heard. I mean, I think in philosophy, we often, especially in moral philosophy, we explicitly rely on into moral, our moral intuitions. I mean, that's a phrase, it's like a technical phrase in philosophy, our moral intuition function. And, it's really hard. And moral intuitions happen when arguments give out. You know, it just seems to me that my moral intuition, for instance, is that, you know, torture is bad. And if someone says, well, what charge is it for that? You know, what can I say? I mean, I don't have an argument for that. That's my moral compass. That's my moral compass, my moral intuition. That's the source of my moral concern. You know, to me, that's what I would call moral bedrock.
Well, that's...
And the intuitions are the most powerful part of it all, because without those, it's impossible to make any kind of progress in order to even have a conversation.
Well, that's, yeah. And that's a dynamic that's run through all our shows, is the interplay, interaction, tension, if you might want to call it that, between the intuitive and the more deliberate. We've referred to those as System 1 and System 2. I love the way the caller talked about the poetry and rhythm of the more deliberative system and how that impacts. And that's the thing that I think is the key to the whole idea of critical thinking and what's going on in our political system and everything, is to figure that dynamic out. Our culture allows us to do statistics and pay attention to statistics, to pay attention to algorithms, big data, and that kind of thing with that more deliberate thinking. But our evolutionarily developed, wired in neurological system has developed our intuition. And it's a wonderful theme that's run through all these programs. So
absolutely.
I thank the caller for bringing that up.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes the point that, you know, morality is not a matter of logic. Moral decisions are, but morality is not.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. We're coming to the end of the hour here. In fact, we've just reached it. Thank you very much, Benjamin Schaefer, philosophy professor and department chair of Humboldt State University. Thanks a lot, Benjamin.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And I want to thank our engineer, Eric Ellen, and thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob. You're so adorable.
Oh, I love
He's
that.
He's blushing.
I love that. Until next time, keep thinking clearly.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, people-powered radio.